Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Andrew Wilson and Muslim debater Daniel Hukikichu collide in Nashville, Tennessee this November 15th and 16th at DebateCon 6 on whether or not Christian or Islamic values are better for society. You don't want to miss it. Grab your tickets by clicking on this link right now so you don't miss out on this epic debate conference featuring that debate and many others.
Hey, everybody. Today we're debating evolution, and we are starting right now with Dr. Dutton's opening statement. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Dutton. The floor is all yours.
Well, thank you for having me. So you've asked me to say my view on why evolution is fact. I want to first of all say that, in a sense, the postmodernists are right. From a scientific perspective, there's no such thing as fact. There's only that which makes sense in light of the current evidence that is at hand. And we must be open-minded to questioning that. And that is why I am open-minded to questioning everything. And that includes evolution itself. So I'm perfectly happy to hear arguments against it. You might have a more nuanced version or whatever it happens to be. The fact, there's no, in a sense, let's put aside this notion of fact, it's not very helpful. The question is, what is the evidence? Well, first of all, if we look at dinosaurs, for example, we have in dinosaur fossils missing links. So we have the idea of evolution, obviously, is that we're all you evolve over long distances of time from a common ancestor. Genetic mutations manifest. Those mutations are useful. And so they are selected for and they spread throughout the population and you see changes. Well, you have in the Tiktaalik a kind of fish dinosaur intermediary. And this is consistent, by the way, there's a consistent order in rocks with this. Or you have in the Archaeopetri a kind of dinosaur bird intermediary. They have elements of both. So this is showing you how one can turn into another. Secondly, in terms of DNA, we have shared DNA. 98 to 99% of our DNA is the same as that of a chimpanzee. So that is consistent with us being strongly related to a chimpanzee and us likely having common ancestry with a chimpanzee. Further consistent with this, there's a so-called GLC gene. This is broken in primates, doesn't work in primates, but it works in other mammals. It's functional. So this tells you that it's likely we are related to these primates. Thirdly, we can see evolution happening in real time. Among microorganisms and small organisms, we can literally note it. For example, antibiotic resistance. It used to be that certain bacteria were not resistant to antibiotics. They now are resistant to it. And this is evolution happening in real time. This is resistance for antibiotics being selected for in certain microorganisms. Secondly, we can see it across as little as 100 years or so. For example, peppered moths were quite light. Then it became polluted. Things like trees became darker. The peppered moths got darker. Now pollution is lessening due to various policies. So the peppered moths are getting lighter again. They are adapting. They are genetically changing according to their environment. That is what evolution is. That's evolution. We can see it happening in real time. We can also see it happening in experiments with E. coli. For example, E. coli under laboratory conditions change in order to be able to metabolize citrate, which they didn't used to be able to do. So this is showing you they are changing. Their genes are changing genetically in real time. We can literally watch it happening. If you look at divergence as well, so Darwin's finches, what you note is that you can see species that are clearly related. They become separated by something, for example, by sea levels rising and them ending up on different islands. And then they become slightly different in terms of how they present. For example, there are flies that have no wings because they no longer need to have wings. And this is consistent to the environment having changed and then having ended up in that environment. Next, you have vestigial structures. So to give an example, why is it that humans, when they are frightened, why do they get goosebumps? Now, they don't get goosebumps when they are hot. So it's nothing to do with heating the body. They get goosebumps when they are frightened. Why? It's vestigial. The answer is we still have the so-called pili muscles. We don't need them, but they haven't been selected out. So we still have they're just useless. We still have pili muscles. Why? Well, those muscles, we would have, our ancestors were covered in hair. Our hair stands up when we're frightened to make ourselves look bigger to our prey or to those that are trying to kill us. That's why they're there. So why would we now have pili muscles which cause hair that's not there to stand up on end when we're frightened? The answer is it's a vestigial trait from our ape ancestors. Next, you have convergent evolution. To give an example, convex eyes have developed in us, in mammals, but also in cephalopods. And yet we are separated by millions and millions and millions of years. But the reason for this is that in both of those environments, convex eyes have been useful. Next, you have the embryology. It's very strange, isn't it, that when a fetus goes through its development at very, very early stages, it literally looks like other animals, ancestors to which it was related in prehistory. So you'll find that vertebrate embryos will all look very similar early on. And you will find that, you will find gill arches, for example, in vertebrate embryos. Why? Because there was a common ancestor with embryo with vertebrates that lived in the sea. And these things are temporary and then they go away. The simplest explanation for that is that we have common ancestors that were substantially different from us, i.e. that they had gill arches because they had gills, because our ancestors emerged from the sea. We can note, by the way, it's been speciation, so which is where you get to a point where it is so different that two groups cannot breed with each other, or they have difficulty breeding with each other, has been observed in real time. And this has occurred, for example, in relation to fruit fly. And so basically, on all of these levels, you have a series of points of information which indicate that, first of all, evolution is clearly real. We can literally watch it happening in real time. So I can't see how anyone could. It is very hard to question that evolution is occurring. And secondly, that humans and every other animal on Earth is a product of evolution in some way. It's a collection of information. It's a case, as it were, that where all of these points of information point in one direction, and that direction is that evolution is real, and that humans and all other animals, dolphins, whatever, are products of it. And that's really my point.
Thank you very much for that opening, Dr. Dutton. And folks, if it's your first time here at Modern Day Debate, I'm your host, Dr. James Coons. I want to welcome you as we are hosting debates on science, religion, and politics. And that includes, as you see at the bottom right of your screen, at our conference, DebateCon 6 this fall. Grab your tickets. It's in Nashville, Tennessee on November 15th. The tickets are linked below. Made by Jim Bob and others are going to be there. You don't want to miss it. With that, we're going to jump into Jim Bob's opening as well. Thank you very much, Jim Bob, as well. The floor is all yours.
What's the timed opener? Sorry, I missed that part.
10 minutes, though you don't have to use all of it.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right. Well, thanks for having me. Thanks, Ed, for calling in. So I just want to point out, Ed started with that science doesn't produce facts, which I agree. But he said there are no facts within this realm that only produces some likelihood of an explanation. I agree. But he also said at the end there that evolution is real, which is assumed to be a category put in the category of fact. So there's a little bit of a contradiction right off the bat. If things are observable, then you don't really need to develop a scientific theory because you just observe the thing that you're assuming is real. So if evolution is real and it's observable, there would be no need for any scientific explanation or experimentation. You simply observe it to be real, and voila, it's real. I I just want to point out the evolution as it's defined, and Ed could push back if he wants after my opener on this, the process by which different kinds of living organisms are thought to have developed and diversified from earlier forms during the history of the Earth. So we're not just speaking about adaptation, we are speaking about the macro claims that species we see today come from entirely different types of animals altogether, which is very distinct from certain groups of animals being influenced by the environment and adapting in real time and changing. These would be more effects of genetic sequences that are already in place. The claim of evolution is that random mutation actually produces novel new information. And I'm not referring to epigenetics. I'm talking about novel new information to the sequence. Not only novel, but then produces some process that produces mechanisms that are specialized and functional. Notice that in Ed's opening, he already granted himself populations. If you grant yourself populations, you already grant yourself all of these appendages, all of these working devices, so to speak, in invertebrates and vertebrates. So he just grants himself the workability of all these things. But the problem is, under evolution, random mutation and any mechanism you argue for, you need to explain how the mechanism produces these things in the first place. This is not the same as abiogenesis, by the way. I know people who propose evolution like to say, well, if I'm debating evolution, I'm not going to debate abiogenesis. Fair enough. I'll grant you something. I'll grant you some group, some rudimentary working replicator. It doesn't tell me, evolution still doesn't tell me how it is it produces specialized things. So the claim also is that natural phenomenon of diversity, populations we see today, is produced by evolutionary mechanism. So how is it, right, if evolution was true or evolution was real and you could see it in real time or you could come to the conclusion that it's real, you would have to be able to tell me and explain from a biological perspective how it is that natural selection through random mutation produces the phenomenon called a multiplicity of populations. You can't. You need to start with populations and then examine what you think the sort of epiphenomenal changes are and what's causing it. You have to grant yourself hearts and livers and lungs and all sorts of things, eyeballs. And then what you have left is, like he said in his opener, is merely looking at similarities between creatures and then drawing this massive logical leap conclusion that it must similar things must come from each other. Well, that's not true. We already know, if we granted the set of facts from the evolutionary view, that phenotypical similarities doesn't entail genetic similarities necessarily. It just assumes that something has a type of function and another thing has a type of function. And the only thing you're observing in natural science is the observation is things have similarities. Isn't it interesting? The question in science is what causes the similarities, not whether or not things are similar. So evolution also assumes that mutations produce accidental phenomenon and functional mechanisms, accidental mechanisms that serendipitously provide survival advantages to the individual and the population. What do I mean by specialized? Let's take the liver, for example, which filters and facilitates expelling of toxins in any body. This is peculiar to vertebrates. Let's take the liver. Evolution proposes that this liver was produced accidentally from a series of random mutations. And is there any reason to believe that a series of random mutations would result in a mechanism just coincidentally being awesome at filtering toxins? It actually has a purpose. It actually has a function to the rest of the body. It doesn't occur in a vacuum. Well, no, we don't have any reason to believe random mutations can produce highly specialized functions, functional appendages that work not just alone, but work in tandem with other isolated, otherwise unrelated particular appendages or mechanisms like the heart and the lungs and the brain and the blood. All of it has to work together. Now, you'll notice a pattern with evolution proponents, as we already saw in his opening. When you ask them questions about something that how it got produced, the simple answer is that it got produced. They grant themselves the previous version every single time. So when you ask, how did that get produced? How did we get snake venom? Well, a previous thing had snake venom. How did you get the part of the thing that he's assuming is a remnant of a lung? How did you get that? Well, a previous thing had it. Well, I'm sorry, but if evolution
is... That's not what we're saying at all.
This is my opener. This is my opener. You can't interrupt the opener, Edward.
I can't talk. All right, okay.
Stop. So it is what you're saying, and we'll see in the cross examination. It's exact. You're still interrupting.
All right.
Do I have to mute you, or
by all means, feel
it's
free.
It's an opener.
No big deal. I think that when I communicated with Ed, I maybe hadn't mentioned the opening. So I forgive me for. We'll just finish off, Jim Bob. You got about 4 minutes and 20 seconds.
Okay. So, if something as specialized as a liver is the product of many generations of mutation in a population, this means that considerably more previous generations survived without the liver. So this is another problem under the evolutionary view. If something gets produced that's highly specialized, you have to say it came from something that already had a version of it. But then that thing needed to produce from something that had a version, and so on, until you get to a point where you actually have to say, there was a time where an insect didn't have legs. There was a time where the liver, an organism, didn't have a liver. Well, they magically grant themselves these very specialized things, right? In order to look at populations, you need to grant yourself a multiplicity of bodies that already know how to reproduce, and all of the appendages and mechanisms for reproduction to be possible in the first place. But when you go back in time and you go, that's interesting. Can you extrapolate how it is that random mutation inside an individual organism and a population of organism produces the process of a functional, hyper-specific, specialized system? Or item in the body. And when you ask this question, the appropriate answer is silence, because there is no explanation for this at all. Now, some of the predictable sets of evidences we expected, he said them all, right? He's going to say the fossil record. Well, the fossil record, appropriately named, would be the fossil narrative. There's nothing about finding any similarity in a fossil, including Tiktaalik, that actually gives you an explanation of how something goes from one thing to another. All you're saying is that thing looks similar, more rudimentary, therefore it must change over time, that there's some process that it changes into this other thing. Well, I'm sorry, when you make a claim something came from another thing, the justification can't be, look, it's similar. That's not enough, right? Similarity is not enough. Right. So they'll go to genetics. They'll go to experiments like bacteria and flies, mosquitoes, which is something introduced to the population that renders its offspring many times incapable of reproducing. That's not evolution. We call that eugenics, by the way, if we were to engineer it. He mentions moths, bacteria, none of which explain the mutations or tracking specifically a mutation that produces this epiphenomenal effect that gives it an advantage. It's more the case that the genetic sequence embedded in these organisms already have it capable of responding to the external world. Goosebumps, you throw a cow in a freezer, the hair gets thicker. These are all reactions to stimuli. A reaction to stimuli is already built into the system. It's already some kind of knowledge in the system itself. You can't track a reaction to stimuli back to a very specific genetic mutation. It's just a massive assumption. That's all it is, a massive assumption. Lastly, I'll finish with my last minute, is that it's often touted that evolution is a scientific theory. I'm sure Ed here would say, yeah, I would say, yes, it is a scientific theory. Well, the problem is, evolution itself can't even pass its way through the basic scientific method that we learn in fifth grade. There's an observation. You ask, okay, what causes this phenomenon? You get blank, right? Do we have a hypothesis that's viable? No, we have nothing we can introduce to test this kind of assumption at the massive time scale we're talking about. It's impossible. If I steel man Ed's position and said, the evolution states that all animals eventually come from a unique, singular, similar ancestor, right? If you said that, that's unfalsifiable too, right? If you start with the conclusion that everything's related merely because there are similar components, similar composition, you couldn't possibly tell me a methodology where you could actually falsify that it's because of ancestry rather than just stating things are similar.
Time. Thank you very much. And folks, we are going to go into the open dialogue. I want to give you a couple of quick reminders out there. We will have a very concise Q&A, as we want to keep our promise, letting the guests get out on the time that we agreed on. So be sure to get your questions in quick, as well as, gentlemen, we'll basically have the open dialogue. If it gets to be where there's an imbalance of who gets to talk as much as the other. What I'll do is put us into 1 or 2 minute segments, or you'll each kind of get like a 1 minute speech to respond to the other. Folks, one last reminder is I have a feeling if you're watching this debate, you'd probably enjoy content from each of these speakers. So check out their links as we're listening today, as I think you'd enjoy content from each of them. With that, we're going to get into the open dialogue. The floor is all yours, gentlemen.
Can I start by saying, you know, I don't think this has to be particularly formal. You say, Jim, Bob, you, they think this, they think this, they think this. I don't think it has to be a sort of an us and them thing, as though it's a fight. It's not a fight. You know, it's you've raised some a lot of points I don't agree with and I think can be refuted. You've raised some interesting points, particularly epistemological points about like, what we can know and what we can't know. And I don't think it has to be a sort of an us and them sort of thing, really. I know it is for some people, but I don't think it has to be. One of the things that you said, which I will pick up on, is you drew a distinction between eugenics and evolution, but there isn't a distinction. Evolution is a process whereby mutant forms of an allele appear via copying errors. And in general, those are bad. They are almost always bad. They almost always do something negative to you, at best something neutral. But very occasionally, depending on the environment you're in, or indeed if the environment you're in changes, then they can have a benefit, and then they will be selected for either by individual selection or by natural or by sexual selection or whatever it happens to be. And there is no distinction. The fact that we want, like farmers taking control of their stock and breeding the best stock, well, that's all eugenics is doing. But it's the same fundamental process of noticing the expression of a gene that has a particular benefit or a particular problem, and either getting rid of it or keeping it. So when we talk about evolution happening in real time, that is evolution happening in real time. If you select for a gene and if you do something and it causes a change in the nature of the population, that is evolution happening in real time. That's the mechanism.
Okay, yeah, but the thing is, when you state the rest of what evolution holds as a theory, a quote theory, is that you're actually holding that in the past there were groups of things that changed through this random mutative process,
yeah,
in conjunction with an environment, right? And there's some sort of like call and response or something. And you're saying from the evolutionary view that it produces not only new forms entirely, but it also produces appendages, right? So when
that's a misunderstanding of the position.
Okay, let's
focus on that. That's a really good point. So one of the things that you said was that we're talking about these minor mutations, these minor changes, these minor copying errors that can be positive but are mainly negative. And isn't it bizarre that they lead to really complex things? You use the word appendage there, and in what you were saying earlier, I underlined it. You used some American phrase that I wasn't familiar with. Where is it now? Being awesome. That's what you said. Being awesome. So that something you can create some extraordinary thing like an eye. But the point there is that if we go back far, the hypothesis is that if we go back far enough in time, you have very simple organisms. And so what the mutation is doing is contributing a tiny, tiny bit to something. And that something might be slightly adaptive. For example, the ability to see a little bit of light, a little tiny, tiny bit of light. And that itself would be potentially, depending on the environment and depending on other factors, adaptive. So that's what it does.
Okay.
And then there's another mutation and a little bit more light.
I understand.
And eventually, over a very, 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 very long time, you might get something that's complex. So it's not like it's a leap.
I understand, but what you just said is a total story. It doesn't tell me how it actually occurs, which if you're making the claim that it does, you need the how. And so if you start with something like very rudimentary cells that are reactive to light, it doesn't follow that random mutation suddenly can start the engines.
Well, there's that word suddenly. There's no suddenly.
Hold on a second. I let you talk. So if it's the case that random mutation produces unsuddenly, but in a long, long time frame, it produces eventually something that's more complex over time. That includes different things that are structured, that pathways, communication pathways, and so forth to other things that are not the eyeball, by the way. So you need to explain from an evolutionary view. You can't just say over a long period of time. Now, you also said the word hypothesis. Now, I hold to a pretty strict definition of the scientific method. So you start with an observation, and then your next step is asking a question, which will give you a hypothesis. So can you tell me from the scientific view what the observation is and what the hypothesis is?
You said that over a long period of time, you can say that. That is the point of, that is the whole point of the model, that you have a very small change, and that that is followed by other small changes and other small changes. And naturally, over a long period of time, those small changes will build up.
That's an assertion.
That's not an assertion at all.
That's absolutely an assertion.
How have you grown your beard?
I can grow my beard over a week and repeat it, whereas you can't repeat your assertion. I can repeat mine. No, you can't.
I don't even know what that means.
Look, you just said, I'll give you your assertion back, Ed. You just said... There, back in deep time, there's a rudimentary element of, let's say, an eye and the cells of what an eye becomes. Right, it's reactive, it's sensitive to light. Right. Over time, you're saying these small little changes. It's reasonable for you to say these small little changes over time that are from random mutations, which are rare to produce anything functional. By the way, by your own admission.
Hold on.
Produce over long periods of time a more complex version of this hypersensitive light skin cells, right? But the thing is, that's an assertion. That right there is an assertion. And you're saying it's not.
Well, anything is an assertion. Your assertion that it's an assertion is an assertion.
Assertions. Come on. Assertions.
That's not a position that you can follow. All I am saying is that the hypothesis is that small things build up over long periods of time.
That's an assertion. How do you know that?
All right, fine. It's an assertion, but it's an assertion that's born out of the data.
How do you know it? It's your claim. How do you know some small things that are simple build up to very complex things over time? How do you know that?
I don't know that they do, but we can.
Why are you saying it?
Because we can track evidence of it across species where this has happened.
Where is the evidence that small things...
As I said to you earlier, in laboratory conditions, we can track evolutionary processes occurring, and we can see and track back how they've built up over time, because we can, indeed, we can manipulate them to do so. So we know, we can see this process happening in real time in the laboratory. So it's not an assertion, it's an observation of empirical reality.
No, you observe something at a micro level of an organism, hold on, doing something in response to stimuli. You know what that is? Hold on.
Let me finish.
I let you talk. You came interrupting me.
The whole presupposition is wrong.
Hold on. So you just said, what do you observe in the laboratory?
I've explained to you.
Tell me, specifically.
I've just said to you, I've given you examples of fruit fly or whatever that have gone blind across time that in the dark.
Is that advantageous?
It doesn't matter whether it's advantageous.
Oh, really?
The question, no. The question is whether it occurs and by what process it occurs. You can have, in certain environments where there's not particularly great Darwinian selection pressure, adaptations that later turn out to be disadvantageous. Evolution doesn't move in a direction. Evolution is random.
It's random. So your own thinking is random.
What does that mean?
If everything that's biologically produced from evolution is produced from random events, then is it follow that your brain was produced by random events?
The mutations are going to be random mutations.
Answer the question, please. I ask you an actual, really sharp question here, Ed, and you're dodging it.
I don't know what the question is.
Listen to my question. if it's true that evolution produced all of the mechanisms in the body, from the intestines to the liver to the heart to the brain, and you said it's produced from random processes with no direction, are you admitting that your own thinking is the process of a random process?
I am admitting, I'm happy to talk about that.
Can you just answer the question?
No, I'm not going to be snapped at.
Oh, now you're tone policing. I ask you a direct question, okay? If it's true that evolution produces things like the brain and the eye from random processes, then your brain right now in operation is the effect of a bunch of random things.
Okay, it's not tone policing. If we're going to have a discussion, then the discussion will be
Are you going to answer the question?
Are you interrupting?
Hold on, one second.
The discussion, the discussion will be done politely. And what you call tone policing is what I would call basically a form of
relation. Just answer my question.
No, I won't just answer the question. I won't be bossed around.
Okay, forgive me, guys. I just want to jump in really quick. Is that I've muted you both. I just want to redirect maybe back to...
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Cool. One of the topics from the openings. And then also is that, folks, I know that it's spirited, namely that it's passionate, but I do want to remind you, folks, that it's just a good faith debate. And so, gentlemen, I will probably break us now into 1 minute little speeches, just to be sure that each side is heard to the same degree. So I'm going to unmute you guys. Is that I do want to go back to one of the topics from the openings per se, though, because though this is definitely an interesting topic, the subject matter from the opening statements is more what I'm interested in. Is that fair? You guys cool with that? And then I also just asked if you could unmute yourselves because I muted you earlier. Pardon my interruption. So
You say it's passionate. It shouldn't need to be passionate. It's not. It shouldn't be a passionate issue, right? All we're talking about is a theory. So there's no need for what you call passion at all, is there? So there's no need for me to be told I'm not answering the question as though it's some trial. We're not on trial. This isn't a trial.
It is. It's literally evolution on trial. It's the name of the debate.
No, it's not. Well, I didn't sign up for evolution on trial. I signed up for a discussion about evolution and whether it's real or not. That's what I signed up for. And if you want to have some trial as though evolution is a crime, then I'm not interested. If you want to have a discussion about the interesting topics, I'm interested.
Let's just, gentlemen, if we can return just to the topics of the openings and my hope is that this is a dialogue that each of you guys walk away with saying like, yes, this is a good, you know, we got to challenge each other's ideas and it was friendly and it was, you know, still lively, but at the same time, I don't want you guys to have any sort of bad blood just because both of you I like. And so let's just jump back to, as an example, if you guys don't mind me asking, maybe the fossil record. This is something that if you guys are comfortable going over to that topic as we jump into these 1 minute responses.
Sure. Ed, give us what you think the fossil record is and what it demonstrates.
All I said with regard to the fossil record is that it demonstrates potentially the process of change, doesn't it? The hypothesis is that animals emerged from the sea. That's the hypothesis. And we have different groups of animal. So we have fish and we have amphibians and we have reptiles and we have mammals. And if this was a process of evolution via which this had happened, I guess that what those that disagree with this are suggesting is that there is a God that has created these things separately, or perhaps there's some other scientific theory I'm not familiar with.
Okay. So it's not, It's not, I just want to give you back the statement at least so make sure we got it. You're saying the fossil record, you're saying that it's a potential. It gives the potential that things have these deep ancestors and things today come from things in the past. And what you're finding in the fossils are essentially, you didn't say this, but I want to know from you. When you find an old fossil and you compare it to something that we have today, a living animal, you're looking at an observation. And would you agree the observation is similarity in phenotype, anatomy?
Yeah, fine. But the point is, the key point is that what you would expect, if the model is that different animals have been created separately in some way, then you wouldn't expect to find fossil evidence of animals that were essentially in between the current separate categories.
Well,
but
no.
But what you find is evidence in the fossil record at the right time and at the right layer.
I just
that there are these animals that are, as it were, between the two.
Okay.
And so that would be consistent with an evolutionary process.
I'm just asking a very simple question. Is it true? No, I asked, you didn't even know what I asked. So is it true that when you look at something old in the fossil and you compare it to something that exists today, is it true that the observation, not the story about the observation, I don't want a story, I just want the observation, that things are similar in anatomy and phenotype? That's all I'm asking for the observation. You found something old and it looks like something, some in between one thing you know and another thing you know. That's an observation, correct?
It may well be an observation, but it's not relevant to my point.
It is, because no, what you're doing, yeah, I'll tell you how. You're making an observation of similarity, and then you're saying, well, look, this thing looks like this other thing we have today, and if we can find another thing in the past that looks similar to that, we can draw out and extrapolate, interpolate a story that one thing led to the other, and that's what you're saying, right? You're saying that it is what you're saying.
No, it's not what I'm saying. I am saying that if you have a hypothesis whereby there are separate, entirely separate organisms, then there would be nothing that would be in between those organisms in the distant past that no longer
exists. That doesn't follow. That doesn't even follow.
I know, but I haven't finished the point. I'll just repeat myself, because it's not about if it follows or it doesn't follow. The point is, the hypothesis of creationism is that there are separate groups that are in whatever you want to call whatever model it is.
Who said anything about that? We're talking about your model.
That's very interesting. No, let's talk about that then. So what is your model then? Tell me.
I don't have a model. You're affirming evolution, and I'm poking holes because I think the view of evolution, absent an alternative explanation or storyline, I don't need another storyline to poke holes in evolution. I've already done it in my opener. So the question is, if you find something similar, you said finding something similar basically goes with the story that things come from an ancestral similar thing, right? But that doesn't actually follow that one thing comes from another. It just follows that things are similar. I'll give you an example. If you found a something that looked like a camel, right? And we didn't know anything about this smaller version of a camel. It was similar enough where you're like, wow, that's interesting. And we related it to a camel. And we said, look, we found its transitional fossil. We're calling like some version of a camel because it looks similar. It must be the case that this is its ancestor. Now, we assume that because we don't know whether or not it exists or not, or it could have existed alongside the current camel. But in this hypothetical, Ed, across the world in like the basin of a Peruvian mountain, they find the same exact skeleton. And instead of celebrating that they found something new, they merely say, look, it's that other thing we know, because they know it coexists with the camel. So the question of like, what's a transitional fossil? You have to assume that it's an ancestor as opposed to something.
But we know it's an ancestor.
No. We
know it's an ancestor because of where it is in the fossil layer.
Nope. That doesn't all.
We know it's old. No, we know it's, we at the very least know it's older. We know it's older.
Older and ancestor. Okay,
you may say that it's unlikely. Sure. Now, this is another point. In general, as a rule in evolution, it is in general things that look similar are related, and that is incongruous. That is congruous with the genetic evidence. So you can look at, for example, something like race is quite interesting in that regard. The races are genetic clusters, and the correlation between traditional race, i.e. the 12 races of man, and the genetics is about 0.9. Now, we didn't know about genetics when we came up with these observations about race differences. We didn't have any understanding of genetics at all, but it turns out it was a correct observation. You are right that sometimes there are similarities that happen by convergent evolution. That is completely true. So you have the similarity, for example, between the eyes of cephalopods and our eyes. Now, we are very distantly related to cephalopods, but we have very similar eyes to cephalopods, and we have more similar eyes to cephalopods than we do to some species that are more similarly related to us. But these are relative outliers in the trend. As a rule, genetics strongly parallels similarity.
Is there anything that's dissimilar that we're related to?
Well, to give an example of something like, yes, I mean, so if we look at races, some people have difficulty understanding this. The most genetically distant race on Earth from sub-Saharan Africans is Australian Aborigines. There is no more distant.
No, no, I'm talking about no, entire. Hold on.
I want to just quick jump in. I do just want to hear the remainder of what Dr. Dutton was saying. So let's just let him finish that sentence or several that he was on, and then we'll come right back to you, Jim Bob. I'll give you a chance. Ed, I just unmuted you, and then Jim Bob, I've unmuted you as well. And then Ed, forgive me, I've got you on mute, and we're ready for you again. Go ahead.
Right, am I ready? Yes. As motion, it's I'm making my point, which is that they have dark skin, right, which is comparable to that of sub-Saharan Africans, but the most similar race to Australian Aborigines is the Southeast Asians. So that's a counterpoint, but it is, as I said to you, relatively rare.
Okay, the question I was asking, I'll be more clear. Is there any other organism or item in the world, a food, something that's not human in the human category, that's dissimilar, but it's related to a human?
Dissimilar, but related to a human. Yeah, probably. I mean, I can't think of something off the top of it, but probably.
Like
yeah,
a banana. Probably. A banana is related to a human, right?
Well, obviously, but very distantly.
Okay, but if a banana is related, but it's dissimilar, you can't rest on similarity between things visually, phenotypically, skin, shape, skull. Well,
you clearly and conspicuously can, because a banana, as I have just said, is as extraordinarily dissimilar genetically from a human as pretty much anything you could imagine.
But it's our ancestor, right? It's a type of ancestor.
It's absolutely not our ancestor.
Is it a relative?
Well, it's a relative in the sense that all life
is related. Is it older than us?
I can't answer that.
You don't know if a banana is older than us?
I would imagine it is, but I can't answer that with certainty because it depends on what banana you're talking about.
I understand.
What banana over time. So I can't answer that question.
Okay. Because if it's the case that everything that's alive that has any genetic makeup at all is all similar and drives back to a singular ancestor, right? That would be the evolutionary view, correct? All genetic things, all things that are genetic, that have genetic information composition, are eventually, if you funnel it down to a single point in history, go back in time. The evolutionary view, Luca, by the way, is the current evolutionary view, that it all comes back to a singular ancestor, right?
That may be the case. I have no reason to think that's the only model.
Okay, that's one model. I don't know if you hold that model. That's why I'm asking you. If it's the case that everything has an ancestor, something that's before it that's older, that it's related to in some way, you have to keep going back in time until you converge to a singular group or item or thing, right? Is the singular thing a replicator? Is it just a replicator we all come from? Because to hold this view, you do have to keep going back in time, Ed, and you have to keep going back. And the same goes for things like, that's why I go granular with the liver, right? You believe that random mutation produces hyper-specialized mechanisms like a liver over time, over a long period of time, right? If evolution was true, you would have to explain how that happens. And
No, you wouldn't. Why would you have to do that?
If you're going to argue that it's the case, you're going to have to justify the argument.
Rubbish.
Oh, you don't have to justify arguments now?
You do not have to explain how. You can make a hypothesis and you can propose that something has happened. That's your hypothesis.
Cool, it didn't happen.
There's no reason, it's not inherent in that you must explain how.
Cool, it didn't happen.
That's not what I said.
I'm saying it didn't happen. I don't have to justify that it didn't happen.
Well, fine. What interests me more, to be honest, is that you've said that you're not a creationist. So I'm really interested to know genuinely, what is your view?
My view of the world is irrelevant to whether or not evolution can defend itself from cross-examination.
No. Well, first of all, I just said, I haven't come on here for something to be cross-examined. And I
wouldn't
have come on here for... No, absolutely. And I wouldn't have come on here if that were the case. My understanding is that I was coming on here for a friendly discussion about problems with evolution or whatever.
Sure.
Because you seem to be treating it like it's some sort of trial.
You just contradicted yourself. Can I talk? I just let you talk.
Gentlemen, okay. Forgive me, but I do want to just be sure is that there's significant overlap in terms of your guys' positions. This is actually, though I think evolution is a large topic, of course, but there's so much agreement between you two that I don't want to miss the forest for the trees.
I was just about to say something. You interrupted me. James interrupted me. It's like, dude, come on. He just said that he came on to this to have a friendly discussion about potential problems in evolution. Now, please tell me, how is it possible we can talk about potential problems in evolution if I can't cross-examine evolution? That would be the act of finding problems in evolution.
No, because the term I'm just interested in, that term, cross-examine, implies it's some sort of court setting, and it's a very serious thing, and there's things at stake, and there aren't. I'm perfectly happy to just have a discussion about these issues. You seem to see it as some sort of thing that you have to win, and that's not what I was told about. What I'm more interested in is, if we go back to one thing we do agree on, which is the nature of science itself. We do agree on that.
No, we don't.
We agree, don't we? Well, what do you think science? What is science?
Science, I told you, is a very specific method. And so that's why I asked you, if you're going to try to bring evolution through science and say, we both agree on science. Well, no, we don't. Because from my view, a scientific theory is only the product of the scientific method. And when I ask, what's the observation? And I can't even get it. Every time I debate this with someone, I can't even get the evolution proponent to give me a single observation that then leads to a hypothesis ever. Well, and I try to do it.
I gave you a whole series of them. I showed you how it could be real time, and you dismissed that as eugenics, which is not. It's just eugenics. There's no such thing as eugenics in this context. It's evolution. Eugenics is evolutionary processes. What I'm more interested in terms of science is the question of a hypothesis.
Yeah.
People that criticize evolution say it's a hypothesis, as though that's a problem. All things in science are hypotheses. And the question is, they are models that best explain the data. And when new data comes along, which questions your model, then you have to revise your model and change your model and come up with a more nuanced and hopefully more accurate model. That is what it does. And so evolution, what scientists would say, is the best model that we currently have in comparison to other models. It's the model that explains the most information. They're not saying it's perfect. They're not saying there's not holes in it. You can pick holes in it. They're saying that it is a case, a different strands that come together, and that most parsimoniously explain the available information. And so if a person has a problem with evolution, then what they are implicitly saying, I assume, is there is a better model. Then tell me what it is.
Well, no, that assumes that it's a valid model. I'm
questioning. No, it doesn't. No.
Can I just let you talk?
One sec.
Why are you so rude?
Really quick.
Because you're such an aggressive man.
Okay.
Unbelievable, man.
I just want to jump in really quick. Pardon my. Is that. Is big picture wise, you guys agree on everything, almost everything, a lot. And. the topic that I had pitched to you guys is evolution true. It's true that I put evolution on trial on the thumbnail and even in the title. Frankly, kind of more for marketing. It just seems a little more catchy. But, you know, is evolution true? I do want to give Ed a chance to ask questions of Jim Bob. In the same way that Jim Bob, I know that you felt like you basically, Ed, I should say, you felt like you've been asked many questions by Jim Bob. I do want to give you a chance to ask questions of Jim Bob. If that's not your style, that's okay. I know that you guys will have different dialogue styles. At the same time, you know, I want to give Jim Bob credit in that I think that his questioning and the interrogating isn't meant to be combative. It's just different conversational styles. So I want to unmute you guys, and I think they're just different conversational styles.
Yeah, James, you just, like, you keep interrupting me when I clarify something, right? And then you switch it over. Like, he just said something about science, and I'm trying to clarify that we don't agree on what a hypothesis is, because I was going to ask Ed, if someone presents a hypothesis in science, Ed, isn't it fair that we question whether it's a viable hypothesis or not?
Yeah, that's fair enough to me. I'm just, my point is that all that science is saying, and I'm sorry if things get a bit sort of tetchy a minute ago, I didn't mean that to happen, but if all it's saying is that it's the hypothesis, when you have a hypothesis, it doesn't happen to be evolution, it can be anything. We will say this hypothesis is the most parsimonious model for explaining the available data. That is what is being proposed. Now, you can say it's a bad hypothesis. You can say there's all kinds of problems with this hypothesis. You can present all kinds of holes with it and problems with it. But then really what you're saying is it is not the best hypothesis to explain the available data. And well, so the legitimate question is, okay, fine, what is? And then okay, we can compare the two hypotheses and we can say which one explains more.
Okay. Is it fair to say, before I say whether or not, before you propose an oppositional hypothesis or something that challenges a hypothesis, is it fair to ask, is it viable? It sounds like you said it's fair. So I'm going to ask you, how do you determine a hypothesis in science, in natural science, is viable or not?
I didn't really know that the word viable is quite the right word. Viable implies almost like something living or dead. All that is, what you do is you say, this potentially explains this observation. So, for example, I said to you earlier about things, well, I mentioned the issue of vestigial things, vestigial tails, that obviously goosebumps, which are not an immune response, they are solely a response to fear and that kind of immune response, not other immune responses. And many other examples. So you say, right, this explains this. The fact, the possibility that we have a common ancestor that had a body covered in hair explains goosebumps. Or the possibility that we had a common ancestor that had a tail explains things like the cockings or whatever it happened, or wisdom teeth, whatever. And so it's saying that explains it. And it's saying that if we have separate species that are, for example, normally the alternative hypothesis is creationism, that are created separately, then it either God is just a bit eccentric and just does things for a laugh and gives us things we don't need for fun, or he creates things separately and you wouldn't have a need for these things. And so therefore evolution explains that in a way that creationism doesn't. If you are saying that there is an alternative hypothesis that is neither creationism nor evolution, I would absolutely relish hearing what it is, because that's fascinating.
Well, I'm just trying to get, like I've always tried to get evolution proponents to do, is can you just take evolution through the scientific method? I mean, do you even believe that for something to be considered a theory under natural science, that it at least should be brought through the scientific method? Do you agree with that?
Yes. The scientific method is that you observe empirical reality and that you theorize a model to explain what you are presented with, and that model is compared to other possible models, and it is the most reasonable hypothesis at a given time with the available data. That is all it is.
That's the scientific method to you?
That is the best approximation, perhaps you're going to nuance it more, of what science involves.
It's well,
observation of reality in which you interpret into a model.
Okay, cool. So if two models that might be contradictory have the same exact data, what is the arbiter for determining which interpretation of the same data is accurate or not? If two model, because you're actually replacing model for what I would call the necessary component in the scientific method, which is experiment. I hold, if you want to know my view, Ed, I hold the view that the only arbiter for two competing hypotheses is an experiment. You hold that it's a model, right? So models aren't actually the arbiter between two competing scientific hypotheses in natural science. But so if they were, you'd be able to tell me, There's two people, they have the same data, they have all the same data available. One draws up a model that's consistent with the data, another draws up a model consistent with the data.
Well, no, they don't.
What do you mean? I'm giving...
You can't have two models that are consistent with the data.
Really?
No.
Really?
Yes, really.
So, look...
Then they're the same model, aren't they? A model is going to make testable predictions based on the available data. That's, you can call that an experiment if you want. I'll just call it. I think that's just a matter of what word you choose to use in a given circumstance. Okay. The idea is that a model makes testable predictions about something, and a different model will make slightly different testable predictions. And if then you see which one has the correct is the correct model based on what predictions are drawn out and what are not.
Okay, cool. So I observe what I call scurvy, right? Between two groups of people. One doesn't get scurvy and one does. Before I know what scurvy is, it's just symptoms, right? And I have data, right? I have available data and I drop a model that X causes scurvy and someone else has the same exact data in front of them and they say Y causes scurvy. You're saying that's an example of two people having the same exact information and data and have different assumed causes, models, assumed causes for the effect. The only arbiter, from my view, in the scientific method, is that you introduce what you assume is causing scurvy, and you remove it. That's called an experiment. But from your view, you didn't say experiment.
No, I agree with you completely. No, I agree with you.
So you agree that an experiment is necessary now?
I think that I was using other words that kind of mean experiment.
Model.
A model that makes testable predictions. How do you test those predictions? You have what you might call an experiment. So I've no problem with that at all. And if one person says that a lack of vitamin C or whatever it is causes scurvy, and another person says that it's some miasma in the air, then and you say, well, how do you get that miasma in the air? Well, you hang around in a place where there's miasma. And then you have one group of people where you give them vitamin C and miasma, and the other way you don't. That's an experiment.
Yeah,
so no, I don't disagree with you at all on that. No.
Okay, but I'm saying you can actually draw models, and you don't have to do an experiment because a model isn't identical to an experiment.
But then it's meaningless. It's a meaningless thing to do
to create.
I agree with you completely. To create a model for it to be worthwhile against a rival model, then there have to be testable predictions, and there have to be things that model can make sense of that the rival does not make sense of. And my proposition, if we compare evolution to pure creationism, is that evolution makes sense of things, such as what I said, vestigial elements of the body or the nature of embryology or the various other things that I presented to you, which the alternative model, creationism, does not make sense of. If you're going to say there's no alternative model, I'm just picking holes, well, fine, there's going to be holes. And there's going to be things that you can nuance. There's going to be things that you can ask questions about. There's going to be things that you could ask better explanations of in any model. And I have no problem with that at all. What I'm interested in is whether a model makes a more parsimonious sense of the available data than another model. And I think you're quite right to say that experiments can be done.
The word
experiment is often used in the context of laboratories and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. That's why I used a slightly different terminology.
Okay, so you've admitted that a model is not an adequate substitute to an experiment, right? And under the evolutionary view, all you really have is a model. If you had an experiment, you could quickly and rigorously go through the scientific method with me, starting with an observation.
What you're doing is you're then slightly altering the meaning of the word experiment to put it almost in a more laboratory context. It is an experiment if you say, here is the available data, these are the predictions this thing is making, these are the predictions this model is making, which predictions are borne out. That is a kind of experiment, and that is what you can do with these two alternative models of how we have got to where we are.
Can you produce a scientific theory without an experiment?
Again, I'm not sure. The problem is, could you use a word other than experiment?
No, we're talking about...
Because you seem to be changing experiment based on what circumstances we're in the discussion.
No, I list the scientific method. If you want to give me an alternative scientific method, you could try. But for my view, the scientific method goes as follows. In nature, you observe a natural phenomenon, in this case, diversity of organisms or something like this. Traits, differing traits, right? Changes in allele frequency, this kind of stuff. That's an observation. The hypothesis would be interesting. I want to create an idea or something that causes some type of mechanism that causes this diversity. That's a valid question to have. But the reason I ask about an experiment is if you assume that X causes diversity in life, right? Mm-hmm. Then you have to introduce X to determine whether, in fact, you're right about X causing this phenomenon.
I don't know what that even means. What do you mean?
If I want to say X causes scurvy, and I think that X causes scurvy, the only way to test whether X causes scurvy is introduce mm-hmm. X and see if it causes scurvy, remove X and see if scurvy is no longer there.
You could have a controlled experiment, yes.
Experiment, right? Now you like the word experiment.
I didn't like or not like it. I want to be precise on what its meaning in given circumstances. It's not about liking or not liking anything.
I just told you what it meant and you agree with me. What I mean by experiment is you see a phenomenon in nature. This would apply to evolution. You see a phenomenon in nature. Then you posit what you think is causing it, whether it's mechanistically or an independent variable like an item. Right. And you
evolution does.
If
the random mutation is what causes the issue.
Okay. How do you introduce random mutation?
How do you introduce random mutation? As explained to you, you can do controlled experiments in laboratories where you can alter the genome of different mini species and you can see what happens accordingly. That's how you introduce it.
Okay, so you manipulate genes inside a laboratory and then you demonstrate, for the most part, that genes, the alteration of genes from a human, by the way, not random.
Hold on.
Let me just give it back to you, dude. You're so bad at interrupting. I can't even believe you're British.
Forgive me. I just want to give.
What the hell does that mean?
It means that you guys usually have good etiquette.
All right, hold on 1 second. Okay. Everything's cool. I just want to give Jim Bob a chance to finish that summary, and I promise we'll come right back to you, Ed, if you feel like it was inaccurate. So, Jim Bob, the floor is all yours. Jim Bob, you're still muted.
What he's referring to in the laboratory is introducing something very specific and or engineering. He's manipulating with some intent to do something, right? We're not talking about something that's randomly happening that we can observe. For instance, some people say, if you introduce alcohol to this bacteria or whatever, we see that it has this reaction and it changes its behavior. Well, that would only be a scientific theory about the cause of alcohol, the effect alcohol has on this particular item, organism. And so the same goes for him going into the lab and human beings finicking with genes and editing stuff. You're talking about engineering now. It doesn't follow that if you manipulate a gene, suddenly it'll grow, it'll start a process to grow an eye or start a process to do anything else. It's merely impacting, by the way, in his own admission, mostly negative effects, not positive effects, mostly negative effects when you tweak bacteria, flies, organisms like this. So he's really talking about damaging. What he's proving is that we can, at the molecular level, inside a laboratory, we can actually damage populations. I agree.
Well, what you could do is just, if you want to talk about genetics and how you can know something is genetic, you can do something like twin adoption studies in humans. And this allows you to control for the other factors, and you can see what issues are genetic and what issues are not.
Yes, genetic problems presuppose
no problems. There's no problems.
Genetic information inside of humans already. You're already starting with humans existing. We're actually talking about something else. A random mutation occurring and setting off a path inside the organism or the group of organisms in the population that follows that it actually produces something unique and workable over time. That's what
How do you explain something like hemophilia? How do you explain how Queen Victoria had hemophilia?
That is totally a red herring to what I just said.
Completely relevant. How do you explain how Queen Victoria, there was no hemophilia at all in the English royal family. How did Queen Victoria have hemophilia? It was X-linked.
Was Queen Victoria a human?
I don't know. Maybe she was a lizard. Maybe we should ask Mr. Ike.
If she was a human and there was a hereditary mechanism that produced some vulnerability to certain diseases or symptoms, is irrelevant to the claim of whether random mutation can
totally
change.
Irrelevant.
Dude,
it's totally
you're
irrelevant.
Interrupting again.
I'm interrupting because you're saying something really silly. I'm trying to help you.
I want to give Jim Bob a chance to finish. Go ahead, Jim Bob.
It doesn't follow that the bigger assumption under evolution that random mutations produce some sort of apparatuses in the body at all.
I've just explained to you that something can be very, very small. It can add to something very, very small. You get polygenic traits. Intelligence is a highly polygenic trait. There are numerous alleles involved in intelligence. It's highly polygenic. Some things are on-off. They're simple. You have the allele, or you have two of the alleles, and you have the condition. So other things, you have multiple alleles to have subtle differences in the condition. They're highly polygenic.
Okay. How does traits entail new workable appendages, though? I asked about appendages.
I don't know whether it's the brain, whether it's an appendage, what you mean, like an arm or something, whether it's whatever. It is a bundles of alleles that come together that are selected for in subtle ways over time, and they will over time produce relatively complex traits. Intelligence is arm, a leg, whatever. I'm interested in intelligence in this regard. Intelligence is a highly polygenic trait. Numerous genes interact to produce the effect and to produce differences in the effect, whereas you get other things like Huntington syndrome or something like that that involve a single mutation.
Is the brain itself as an organism a trait or a mechanism?
It seems to be a semantic question. It's so irrelevant, I'm not even going to answer it.
You're not going to answer the question of whether or not...
What you seem to be doing is you seem to be taking... What's unbelievable?
You're bad faith. That's what's unbelievable.
No, I'm not bad faith. How am I bad faith?
You just mentioned the term trait, and then we're talking about...
The brain is not a trait. The brain is in genetic terms...
Why didn't you answer them?
Because it's just such a preposterous...
Okay, the brain is not a trait. Great. So tell me how random mutation, from the trait perspective, let's say I grant you random mutations produce traits. How is it that you jump from traits to producing a brain among humans? How do you do that?
I want to give that a chance to respond.
But no, my dear fellow, if you're going to talk about bad faith, what you seem to do is focus on the semantics of words. And you think that it's a great victory if you've caught someone out with regard to some slight, and you do seem to see things in terms of victory and defeat, which is peculiar to me.
I evolved to do that. Why are you confused?
I was under the impression that I was talking. And it was terribly, terribly rude and un-British to interrupt.
I evolved
goodness,
to interrupt.
Goodness okay, me, right, goodness me, I can't believe, just, goodness me, just wanna... goodness me, goodness me, I can't believe you're American. It is irrelevant what these slight nuances of words mean and whether one person can define, I don't know, flocky knocky helipilification slightly better than somebody else. It doesn't matter. You know, you're picking up on very, very minor things, which is irrelevant to the broader issue and doesn't really interest me. What I'm interested in and what I thought I was going to get actually was justification for an alternative and better view than evolution. And you're not, I haven't had that.
I do want to jump in really quick because there has to be someone that has the last word before we go into the Q&A. Is anyone willing to defer to the other in terms of allowing them the last word?
I'll give Ed the last word. That's fine with me.
Okay.
I don't really have a last word. Again, I didn't think this was going to be some sort of... thing on trial. All I'm saying is that I'll just put my original point, which is that all that the scientific system is saying is you have alternative models that make predictions, and you judge a model on the degree to which it makes correct predictions, on the degree to which it explains the data which you see before you. And you will never have a perfect model. And if we want to talk about evolution, evolution is not a perfect model in understanding the nature of life, in so much as it begs the question, how did life start? And I have seen does not explain something as fundamental, really, as far as I can see, as how life started. So that's an issue with the model. But it seems to me that it makes better predictions than the creationist model.
We'll jump over to the Q&A. And folks, I want to remind you that our guests are linked in the description box. We're going to have a guest, an extra third guest, jump in at the end of this Q&A. So hang in there for that particular gentleman, a friend of Jim Bob's. But I do want to jump into these questions. Folks, we won't have more than, we'll have about at most 30 minutes for this Q&A. And then we have to let our guests go. And it's been a lively debate. My goal was that today would be a debate. I know that you guys have different conversational styles for the open dialogue portion. Is that nonetheless, I hope that at the end of it, it's something where it's kind of like, hey, well, you know, if you're ever in town, we can grab a drink and have a chat and get along. Is that folks, our guests agree on many things, particularly in politics. This one, first coming in from Red Fox, says, Dr. Dutton, you cannot use evidence used to create a theory to also test the theory. It's circular. You also, by the way, they say, you also have no evidence of life beginning. How do you resolve these issues together?
You can't... This is just the use of high order language, I think, to sort of try to sound profound. I don't, what does that even mean? It's not circular. The evidence is the available data before us. You come up with a model, you say, and you have an alternative model. You say this model predicts or makes sense of more of this data than this model. You test that against the available data. You're either right or you're wrong with reference to the other model. All that is being, you're making out that evolution is some sort of dogma for people. And unfortunately, you're right. You're right for a lot of people. They're closed-minded and they wouldn't even have this discussion today. Their attitude is that people that don't believe in evolution are just nuts as idiots. But that was the attitude of people when evolution first came along. But as a model, the attitude was, you believe in evolution. You think we're sent from monkeys. You're an idiot. Right? It was dogmatic. That is a misrepresentation of what is being maintained. What's being maintained is you have two alternative models. One of them makes sense of more data than the other. And as for your question, as for your comment about the start of life, yeah, you're right. Evolution does not explain. I've seen them try to attempt to explain it in various things I've read about how we go from not being alive to being alive. But it really doesn't make much sense to me. A slow process by which you do it, but I don't understand where the kind of spark of life comes from. And I don't think evolution explains that.
This one coming in from JSS Tiger says, it seems to me that evolution deniers generally have a religious agenda. Does the skeptic have a religious motive? I think they mean, Jim Bob, you being the skeptic of evolution.
No, that's why when I debate this topic, I don't do theology versus evolution. I'm interested in what evolution posits. Irrelevant to my view. And I wonder from their own view, I try to go internal. Like, can they explain the things that they're assuming happen, right? That's what I want to know. And so I don't need to insert my beliefs. I just simply, by the way, there are many atheists who don't hold a religious belief at all who are highly skeptical. I'm sure Ed would agree that he's maybe even met these people. So it doesn't follow that you have an agenda simply because you're cross-examining something from inside their paradigm. No, there's no agenda. If I had an agenda, I would be like,
I think what's interesting,
I'd be like, Ed, you're evil. You're evil because you believe in, like, I don't use those arguments. They're bad arguments. Anyway, from the theist. So what I want to know is, from a scientific perspective, can you defend evolution and all of the claims that are entailed by the view? That's all I'm interested in.
What I think is an interesting question there with regard to Jim Bob's comment, very good point about people that are atheists or whatever that don't believe in evolution. Yes, you're right, there are. But they won't admit that. So evolution is the best hypothesis in relation to other hypotheses, but it is also a dogma. And there's a lot of people have this view that basically if you're intelligent and sophisticated, you must believe in evolution. If you don't, you're stupid, which is absurd. But therefore they will say, oh, yeah, I believe in evolution. I believe in evolution, but they don't. No, they don't. They believe evolution stops at the neck, at least in humans. Evolution stops at the neck. I don't know if you're still there. You've completely frozen.
We can still hear you. It's just that your video feed is frozen. But we heard everything you just said for sure.
All right. Okay. Yeah. So they don't believe in evolution. They believe in evolution, but they don't. And that's a totally inconsistent position.
You got it. And reminder, folks, both of our guests are linked in the description box. I encourage you to check their links out. Even if you disagree, folks, there's a lot of value from getting their positions straight from them rather than what people say that they're saying. Actually, Religious says, if evolution is true and evolution is random, what species have gone extinct not because of changes in the environment, but due to random mutation?
Is that for me or for him?
That's for you, I think.
You could argue that you don't go extinct due to random mutation. You change due to random mutation, and you change enough across time that you are no longer the same species as the other species. You are separated either through gene flow or separated by mountains or whatever, and so you are no longer the same thing. So you don't, if you're evolved to a particular environment and your environment radically changes because there's a volcanic eruption or something, then the whole what you call species can just die out. But that's quite rare. What's more likely to happen is that some, via random mutation, or some that are related to it, will survive and will carry on. So I'm not quite sure how you would go. The random mutations will carry on among the survivors, unless the whole species is wiped out at a stroke, which has happened historically, of course.
I wanted to add to that. From that perspective, like the view is that there's random mutation that produces traits, and then the traits express themselves in reality, and reality is composed of an external world, which we call the environment, which plays in. There's a sort of pull and push there that that's what natural selection is assumed to be. Like, but the thing is, like, we know that environments change over time slowly, but also drastically. And what I find interesting is, like, I don't know that Ed or someone else could give me the threshold at which immediate drastic events like volcanoes and earthquakes are no longer considered like the environment. That's like some other thing that happens that doesn't count insofar as the organisms or populations not adapting to that, right? They're like these instances that don't count or they're more dramatic. So we don't really think about those things. And I wonder if Ed, is there a symmetry breaker between extreme events that are in the environment and slower, subtle events? And what is the symmetry breaker other than our own experience of one being very quickly and one being very long? Do you know what I mean by my question?
I do know what you mean. I mean, it's a philosophical question. It's like saying, where would you draw the line between there being short people and tall people? Well, you can't draw that line, but there are still... For predictive purposes, we can say there are tall people and there are short people, and there are people that are in the middle. And the question in science is that you come up with what you might call a cautious essentialism. So the world is swirling chaos, and you come up with a system of categories that allow correct predictions to be made. But it's inherently unstable. There will always be things on the borders of those categories, always things that don't quite fit. So that is why that issue comes up of where do you draw the line. We do not. That is the problem with the nature of scientific categories. It's very hard to draw a precise line like that. But that doesn't mean it's not useful to foster the categories, because those categories allow correct predictions to be made and allow us therefore to better understand things or to negotiate life.
Well, that's why I asked the question earlier in the debate, which I think is an important and interesting philosophical entailment of evolution. If everything's in flux and we just do our best to properly categorize things in the here now, from an evolutionary view, your own brain is still in some sort of evolutionary development, but yet we're trusting a thing that, according to you, is a part of the world also in flux. So we have brains in flux, but we're trusting our brains in flux to organize and categorize something else that's also in flux outside of us.
I'm going to add the last word and then go to the next question.
Well, that's a very, very interesting question that Jim Bob has asked. And it raises sort of William James pragmatism, that sort of thing. How can we truly know anything and be sure of anything? And we can't. But from a pragmatic perspective, we can't live like that. And so we categorize our world and live as though certain things are true. But Jim Bob is quite right about that. That's a good point. Yeah.
You got it. We'll jump to the next question. This one from Kevin Blackwell says, question for Dr. Ed, have we ever observed a mutation fixating across an entire species? And how many generations did it take in that species?
Well, the nature of a species, or indeed a subspecies, is that they are distinct from another species by virtue of the extent to which they have certain genes in common, or basically genotypic frequencies. That's what we're talking about: differences in genotypic frequencies. That's what distinguishes a subspecies from another subspecies, and a species from another species. So. And there are certain gene forms, I can't name them on the top of my head, but I know this is true, that you only get in certain species. And so in that sense, yes, you have certain genes that are only found in certain specific species. I cannot tell you how, and that's inherently the case with basically pretty much all different distinct species. I can't tell you how long it takes for that to happen, no. That would depend on all kinds of factors, like the environmental change and the speed of change and whatever.
You got this one from Matthew Ganak says, another strong line of evidence for common descent is biogeography. With the Wallace line in Oceania, I can't remember if I'm saying that right, being a good example. So in the Australia area, they say Alfred Russel Wallace noticed markedly different fauna separated by this deep water barrier.
Is that it? I would respond in saying that geography, where a creature lives, would necessarily be compatible with how the creature lives. That's not really pointing to anything other than animals that live in this environment operate as such, consistent with living in that environment. Animals who live in water, they look and they're formed in a way that's consistent with living in water. It doesn't follow that one comes from the other merely because you can find animals that existed in a way consistent with their environment. Like, how else would anything live anyway? You know, it doesn't, you know, what, how do you falsify that? Find an animal that lives in an environment that it can't live in? That doesn't make sense anyway. You would never find an animal that lived in a place it couldn't possibly live in. It's irrelevant.
You could find an animal that was extraordinarily similar to another animal, and you could note from the record where it had been separated via some kind of massive geographic change, such as desertification or coming along of a sea. And then you could notice that there would be differences in the two environments, and you could see that they had adapted quite separately to those environments, and that was the point of Darwin's finches.
Right, and I would just make a distinction from that view between adaptation and the assumption that adaptation, if you granted it, the ability for an existing population or an animal to interact with its direct environment over time, it still doesn't follow that one eventually slowly produces chains of events that splinter off into entirely new animals completely. You know, it doesn't follow that happened merely because you find similarities. You lost the audio.
I want to give Jim Bob the last word on that question, just because it was originally directed at him. Marilyn says, "Okay, we are all The image of God, known before the world began, we always were and always will be. Evolution and creation are psyops. Okay. Even Lord says, if Earth Daddy real, why doesn't a present biogenically evolve under my science miss tree? Dun dun. L's in the chat. Common Jim Bob victory. I don't know what that means, but I think that is it for our questions. Let me double check, as we have a guest, a special guest that's going to pop in and take Dr. Ed Dutton's place just in a few seconds here. I do want to remind you folks, our guests are linked in the description. Big picture wise, they agree on so many things and in different ways. In other words, they maybe converge on many political topics, but have different means of getting to that convergent point. So I do want to encourage you, even if you disagree with them in this debate, check out our guest links right now. We really do appreciate our guests. Thank you, folks, for watching, but most of all, thank you for our guests. It's been a true pleasure to have you here, Dr. Ed Dutton, and Made by Jim Bob.
Thank you. I have one more question for Ed, though, if you don't mind. Just one more final question. If evolution and its behaviors of different species, if there's something called an invasive species or type of organism or population, and you deem it invasive, and the reaction from the native species is to somehow fight it off or eradicate it. Let's just imagine that's possible under evolution, that this response to something invading develops a defense and ultimately an offense to eradicate it. Does it follow? Do you introduce an ethical thing that's not found in evolution to fight against the notion of, like, looking at humans as invasive in certain areas and justifying a group of humans eradicating another by way of saying, well, they're invasive? Like, is that consistent with evolution? And if it's consistent with evolution, do you introduce an ethical view against that?
Ethics is nonsense on sticks, and it's completely irrelevant to my point. Ethics is just too... I don't care about ethics. I'm not here to talk about ethics.
Okay, but under the evolutionary view, is it not consistent to eradicate invasive species and include human beings as a type of kind that you could eradicate?
Are you asking me if it would be adaptive for a group, including humans, to would it be adaptive for them to eradicate those which were competing with them for resources?
Yeah.
Yes, it would.
It would be advantageous. Okay.
Want to say, folks, check out our guest links. We're going to let Dr. Ed Dutton go, and to replace him is our surprise special guest talking about DebateCon. But
do I get to plug my stuff? Do I get to plug
please
my?
Do. You know, this is an absolute.
I plug my stuff. Do. Okay, so yes, chaps, sir, yes. Can I just say? You know, I'm sorry if it got a bit tense between me and Jim Bob at some points. Perhaps at some points that was my fault. Although I am completely sober. Perhaps at some point it was his. I have no idea. I'm sorry about that. But I think it's been an interesting debate. I think he's raised some jolly interesting points about evolution. And I was particularly interested, frankly, in discussing the philosophical questions and the issues that underpin it and in the epistemological question. So I'd like to thank him for chatting to me. And I'm sorry if I was un-British at some point. And thanks a lot for that. And thanks a lot for having me, James. And so yeah, if you're new then, could you please subscribe to my channels, Jolly Heretic, on YouTube and on Substack, where I put all my stuff and stuff that I can't put on YouTube and whatever. And then I apply evolution to what's happening at the moment. And in particular, I've applied evolution to wokeness. And I think evolution makes sense of wokeness. I think wokeness is a selection event that will eventually bring humanity back to being genetically healthy and genetically based. And I look at that in a book I've done called Woke Eugenics, How Social Justice is a Mask for Social Darwinism. So that might interest you. So thanks for having me in tally-ho.
Thank you, Edward. I appreciate it.
Our pleasure to have you. We'll let you go if you need to sign off from Zoom. But yeah, I want to say, folks, it's been an excellent debate. It's been intense. And if there was any sort of it was probably my fault in terms of communicating the expectations for the debate. But nonetheless, it sounds like everybody's wrapped up in a way that we're all on good terms. So that's great. Check out our guests. They're linked in the description box, folks. What are you waiting for? Click on their links right now. And then Our special guest, Andrew Wilson, will be arriving in just a moment as he'll be talking about DebateCon. But I want to say thank you very much. What I'm going to do is, let me just give Andrew a reminder. I'm going to let our guest go backstage. So I'll be back in literally about 15 seconds, folks. So stick around as Jim Bob, Andrew Wilson, and I will be back in just a moment.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Skyline's new chicken chili is here. Now you can enjoy that legendary Skyline taste with a new protein option. Try Skyline's chicken chili on Waze, Coney's, and all your Skyline favorites. Feeling good. It's Skyline time.